Welcome. This is Signal. Have you ever come across a picture of a beautiful, old, spooky, abandoned building and thought, I would love to live there. Just clean it out, fix it up, stash my skeletons, and make friends with the ghosts. It would be perfect. But before you commit to any new or very, very old real estate, please listen to this reinterpretation of H.P. Lovecraft's cautionary tale, The Haunter of the Dark, published December 1936 in Volume 28 of Weird Tales. I have seen the dark universe yawning, where the black planets roll without aim, where they roll in their horror unheeded, without knowledge or luster or name. Cautious investigators will hesitate to challenge the common belief that Roberta Lake was killed by lightning or by some profound nervous shock derived from an electrical discharge. It is true that the window she faced was unbroken, but nature has shown herself to be capable of many freakish performances. The expression on her face may have easily arisen from some obscure muscular source unrelated to anything she saw, while the entries in her diary are clearly the result of a fantastic imagination aroused by certain local superstitions and by certain old matters she had uncovered. As for the anomalous conditions at the deserted Church of Federal Hill, the shrewd analyst is not slow in attributing them to some charlatanry, conscious or unconscious, with at least some of which Blake is secretly connected. For after all, the victim was a writer and painter wholly devoted to the field of myth, dream, terror, and superstition, and avid in her quest for scenes and effects of a bizarre, spectral sort. Her earlier stay in the city, a visit to a strange old man, deeply given to occult and forbidden lore as she, had ended amidst death and flame, and it must have been some morbid instinct that drew her back from her home in Milwaukee. She may have known of the old stories, despite her statements to the contrary in the diary, and her death may have nipped in the bud some stupendous hoax designed to have a literary reflection. Among those, however, who have examined and correlated all this evidence, there remain several who cling to the less rational and commonplace theories. They are inclined to take much of Blake's diary at its face value and point significantly to certain facts, such as the undoubted genuineness of the old church record, the verified existence of the disliked and unorthodox Starry Wisdom sect prior to 1877, the recorded disappearance of an inquisitive reporter named Edwin M. Lillibridge in 1893, and above all, the look of monstrous, transfiguring fear on the face of the young writer when she died. It was one of these believers who, moved to fanatical extremes, threw into the bay a curiously angled stone and its strangely adorned metal box found in the old church steeple, the black windowless steeple, and not the tower where Blake's diary said those things originally were. Though widely censored, both officially and unofficially, this man, a reputable physician with a taste for odd folklore, averred that he had rid the earth of something too dangerous to rest upon it. Between these two schools of opinion, the listener must judge for himself. The papers have given the tangible details from a skeptical angle, leaving for others the drawing of the picture as Roberta Lake saw it, or thought she saw it, or pretended to see it. Now studying the diary closely, dispassionately, and at leisure, let us summarize the dark chain of events from the expressed point of view of their chief actor. Young Blake returned to Providence in the winter of 1934-35, taking the upper floor of a venerable dwelling in a grassy court off College Street, on the crest of the Eastward Hill near the Brown University campus and behind the marble John Hay Library. It was a cozy and fascinating place, in a little garden oasis of village-like antiquity, where huge friendly cats sun themselves atop a convenient shed. The square Georgian house had a monitor roof, classic doorway with fan carving, small paned windows, and all the other earmarks of early 19th century workmanship. Inside were six-paneled doors, wide floorboards, a curving colonial staircase, white Adam period mantels, and a rear set of rooms 3 steps below the general level. Blake's study, a large southwest chamber, overlooked the front garden on one side, while its west windows, before which she had her desk, faced off from the bow of the hill and commanded a splendid view of the lower town's outspread roofs and of the mystical sunsets that flamed behind them. On the far horizon were the open countryside's purple slopes. Against these, some 2 miles away, rose the spectral hump of Federal Hill, bristling with huddled roofs and steeples whose remote outlines wavered mysteriously, taking fantastic forms as the smoke of the city swirled up and enmeshed them. Blake had a curious sense that she was looking upon some unknown, ethereal world, which might or might not vanish in a dream if she ever tried to seek it out and enter it in person. Having sent home for most of her books, Blake brought some antique furniture suitable for her quarters and settled down to write and paint, living alone and attending to the simple housework herself. Her studio was in the north attic room, where the panes of the monitor roof furnished admirable lighting. During that first winter, she produced 5 of her best-known short stories, The Burrower Beneath, The Stairs in the Crypt, Shagai, The Veil of Panath, and The Feaster from the Stars, and painted 7 canvases, studies in nameless, unhuman monsters, and profoundly alien, non-terrestrial landscapes. At sunset, she would often sit at her desk and gaze dreamily off at the outspread west, the dark towers of Memorial Hall just below the Georgian Courthouse belfry, the lofty pinnacles of the downtown section, and that shimmering, spire-crowned mound in the distance, whose unknown streets and labyrinthian gables so potently provoked her fancy. From her few local acquaintances, she learned that the far-off slope was a vast Italian quarter, though most of the houses were remnant of older Yankee and Irish days. Now and then, she would train her field glasses on that spectral, unreachable world beyond the curling smoke, picking out individual roofs and chimneys and steeples, and speculating upon the bizarre and curious mysteries they might house. Even with the optical aid, Federal Hill seemed somehow alien, half-fabulous, and linked to the unreal, intangible marvels of Blake's own tales and pictures. The feeling would persist long after the hill had faded into the violet, lamp-starred twilight, and the courthouse floodlights and the red industrial trust beacon had blazed up to make the night grotesque. Of all the distant objects on Federal Hill, a certain huge, dark church most fascinated Blake. It stood out with a special distinctness in certain hours of the day and at sunset. The great tower and tapering steeple loomed blackly against the flaming sky. It seemed to rest on an especially high ground, for the grimy facade and the obliquely seen north side with the sloping roof and the tops of the great pointed windows rose boldly above the tangle of surrounding ridgepoles and chimney pots. Particularly grim and austere, it appeared to be built of stone, stained and weathered with the smoke and storms of a century and more. The style, so far as the glass could show, was that earliest experimental form of Gothic revival which preceded the stately Upjohn period and held over some of the outlines and proportions of the Georgian age. Perhaps it was reared in 1810 or 1815. As the months passed, Blake watched the far-off forbidding structure with an oddly mounting interest. Since the vast windows were never lighted, she knew it must be vacant. The longer she watched, the more her imagination worked, till at length she began to fancy curious things. She believed that a vague, singular aura of desolation hovered over the place, so that even the pigeons and swallows shunned its smoky eaves. Around the towers and belfries, her glass would reveal great flocks of birds, but here they never rested. At least, that is what she thought and set down in her diary. She pointed the place out to several friends, but none of them had been on Federal Hill or possessed the faintest notion of what the church was or had been. In the spring, a deep restlessness gripped Blake. She had begun her long-planned novel, based on a supposed survival of the witch cult in Maine, but was strangely unable to make progress with it. More and more, she would sit at her westward window and gaze at the distant hill and the black, frowning steeple shunned by the birds. When the delicate leaves came out on the garden boughs, the world was filled with a new beauty, but Blake's restlessness was merely increased. It was then that she first thought of crossing the city and climbing bodily up to that fabulous slope into the smoke-wreathed world of dream. In late April, just before the eon-shadowed Walpurgis time, Blake made her first trip into the unknown. Plodding through the endless downtown streets and the bleak, decayed squares beyond, she came finally upon the ascending avenue of century-worn steps, sagging Doric porches, and blear-paned cupolas, which she felt must lead to the long-known, unreachable world beyond the mists. There were dingy, blue-and-white street signs, which meant nothing to her, and presently she noted the strange, dark faces of the drifting crowds and the foreign signs over curious shops in brown, decade-weathered buildings. Nowhere could she find any of the objects that she had seen from afar, so that once more she half fancied that the Federal Hill of that distant view was a dream world never to be trod by living human feet. Now and then, a battered church facade or a crumbling spire came into sight, but never the blackened pile that she sought. When she asked a shopkeeper about the great stone church, the man smiled and shook his head, though he spoke English freely. As Blake climbed higher, the region seemed stranger and stranger, with bewildering mazes of brooding brown alleys leading eternally off to the south. She crossed two or three broad avenues and once thought she glimpsed a familiar tower. Again she asked a merchant about the massive church of stone, and this time she could have sworn the plea of ignorance was feigned. The dark man's face had a look of fear, which he tried to hide, and Blake saw him make a curious sign with his right hand. Then, suddenly, a black spire stood out against the cloudy sky on her left, above the tiers of brown roofs lining the tangled, southerly alleys. Blake knew at once what it was, and plunged toward it through the squalid, unpaved lanes that climbed from the avenue. Twice she lost her way, but she somehow dared not ask any of the patriarchs or housewives who sat on their doorsteps or any of the children who shouted and played in the mud of the shadowy lanes. At last, she saw the tower plain against the southwest, and a huge stone bulk rose darkly at the end of an alley. Presently, she stood in a windswept open square, quaintly cobblestoned, with a high bank wall at the farther side. This was the end of her quest, for upon the wide, iron-railed, weed-grown plateau which the wall supported, a separate lesser world, raised fully 6 feet above the surrounding streets, there stood a grim, Titan bulk, whose identity, despite Blake's new perspective, was beyond dispute. The vacant church was in a great state of decrepitude. Some of the high stone buttresses had fallen, and several delicate finials lay half lost among the brown, neglected weeds and grasses. The sooty Gothic windows were largely unbroken, though many of the stone mullions were missing. Blake wondered how the obscurely painted panes could have survived so well in view of the known habits of small boys the world over. The massive doors were intact and tightly closed. Around the top of the bank wall, fully enclosing the grounds, was a rusty iron fence whose gate, at the head of the flight of stairs from the square, was visibly padlocked. The path from the gate to the building was completely overgrown. Dissolution and decay hung like a pall over the place, and in the birdless eaves and the black, ivyless walls, Blake felt a touch of the dimly sinister beyond her power to define. There were very few people in the square, but Blake saw a policeman at the northerly end and approached him with questions about the church. He was a great, wholesome Irishman, and it seemed odd that he would do little more than make the sign of the cross and mutter that people never spoke of that building. When Blake pressed him, he said very hurriedly that the Italian priest had warned everyone against it, vowing that a monstrous evil had once dwelt there and left its mark. He himself had heard dark whispers of it from his father, who recalled certain sounds and rumors from his boyhood. There had been a bad sect there in the old days, an outlaw sect that had called up awful things from some unknown gulf of night. It had taken a good priest to exorcise what had come, though there did be those who said that merely the light could do it. If Father O'Malley were alive, there would be many a thing he could tell. But now there was nothing to do but let it alone. It hurt nobody now, and those who owned it were dead or far away. They had run away like rats after the threatening talk in 77, when people begun to mind the way folks vanished now and then in the neighborhood. Some day the city would step in and take the property for lack of heirs, but little good would come of anybody's touching it. Better it be left alone for the years to topple, lest things be stirred up that ought to rest forever in their black abyss. After the policeman had gone, Blake stood staring at the sullen, steepled pile. It excited her to find that the structure seemed as sinister to others as it did to her, and she wondered what grain of truth might lie behind those old tales the bluecoat had repeated. Probably they were mere legends evoked by the evil look of the place, but even so, they were like a strange coming to life of her own stories. The afternoon sun came out from behind the dispersing clouds, but seemed unable to light up the stained, sooty walls of the old temple that towered on its high plateau. It was odd that the green of spring had not touched the brown, withered growths in the raised, iron-fenced yard. Blake found herself edging nearer the raised area and examining the bank wall and its rusted fence for possible avenues of ingress. There was a terrible lure about the blackened fane, which was not to be resisted. The fence had no opening near the steps, but around the north side, there were some missing bars. She could go up the steps, walk around the narrow coping outside the fence, till she came to the gap. If people feared the place so wildly, she would encounter no interference. She was on the embankment, and almost inside the fence before anyone noticed her. Then, looking down, she saw the few people in the square edging away and making the same sign with their right hands that the shopkeeper in the avenue had made. Several windows were slammed down, and a fat woman darted into the street and pulled some small children inside a rickety, unpainted house. The gap in the fence was very easy to pass through, And before long, Blake found herself wading amidst the rotting, tangled growths of the deserted yard. Here and there, the worn stump of a headstone told her that there had once been burials in the field, and that, she saw, must have been very long ago. The sheer bulk of the church was oppressive now that she was close to it, but she conquered her mood and approached to try the three great doors in the facade. All were securely locked, so she began a circuit of the cyclopean building in a quest to find some minor, more penetrable opening. Even then, she could not be sure that she wished to enter the haunt of desertion and shadow, yet the pull of its strangeness dragged her on automatically. A yawning and unprotected cellar window in the rear furnished the needed aperture. Peering in, Blake saw a subterranean gulf of cobwebs and dust faintly litten by the western sun's filtered rays. Debris, old barrels, and ruined boxes and furniture of numerous sorts met her eye, though over everything lay a shroud of dust which softened the sharp outlines. The rusted remains of a hot air furnace show that the building had been used and kept in shape as late as the mid-Victorian times. Acting almost without conscious initiative, Blake crawled through the window and let herself down to the dust-carpeted and debris-strewn concrete floor. The vaulted cellar was a vast one without partitions, and in a corner, far to the right, amid dense shadows, she saw a black archway evidently leading upstairs. She felt a peculiar sense of oppression at being actually within the great spectral building, but kept it in check as she cautiously scouted about, finding a still intact barrel amidst the dust and rolling it over to the open window to provide for her exit. Then, bracing herself, she crossed the wide, cobweb-festooned space toward the arch. Half-choked with the omnipresent dust and covered with ghostly gossamer fibers, she reached and began to climb the worn stone steps which rose into the darkness. She had no light, but groped carefully with her hands. After a sharp turn, she felt a closed door ahead, and with a little fumbling, revealed its ancient latch. It opened inward, and beyond it she saw a dimly illuminated corridor lined with worm-eaten paneling. Once on the ground floor, Blake began exploring in a rapid fashion. All the inner doors were unlocked, so that she freely passed from room to room. The colossal nave was an almost eldritch place, with its drifts and mountains of dust over box pews, altar, hourglass pulpit and sounding board, and its titanic ropes of cobweb stretching among the pointed arches of the gallery and intertwining the clustered Gothic columns. Over all this hushed dissolution played a hideous leaden light as the declining afternoon sun sent its rays through the strange, half-blackened panes of the great apsidal windows. The paintings on those windows were so obscured by soot that Blake could scarcely decipher what they had represented, but from the little that she could make out, she did not like them. The designs were largely conventional, and her knowledge of obscure symbolism told her much concerning some of the ancient patterns. The few saints depicted bore expressions distinctly open to criticism, while one of the windows seemed to show merely a dark space with spirals of curious luminosity scattered about in it. Turning away from the windows, Blake noticed that the cobweb cross above the altar was not of the ordinary kind, but resembled the primordial Ankh or Crux Ansata of shadowy Egypt. In a rear vestry room beside the apse, Blake found a rotting desk and ceiling-high shelves of mildewed, disintegrating books. Here, for the first time, she received a positive shock of objective horror, for the titles of those books told her much. They were the black, forbidden things which most sane people have never even heard of, or have heard of only in furtive, timorous whispers. The banned and dreaded repositories of equivocal secret and immemorial formulae which have trickled down the stream of time from the days of man's youth and the dim, fabulous days before man was. She had herself read many of them, the Latin version of the abhorred Necronomicon, the sinister Liber Ivonis, the infamous Cults de Ghouls of Comte de Eret, the Unaussprechen de Culten of Vengeance, and old Lugwood Prim's hellish De Vermis Mysteris. But there were others she had known merely by reputation, or not at all. The Noctic Manuscripts, the Book of Dazan, a crumbling volume of wholly unrecognizable characters, yet with certain symbols and diagrams shudderingly recognizable to the occult student. Clearly, the lingering local rumors had not lied. This place had once been the seat of an evil older than mankind and wider than the known universe. In the ruined desk was a small, leather-bound record book filled with entries in some odd cryptographic medium. The manuscript writing consisted of some common traditional symbols used today in astronomy and anciently in alchemy, astrology, and other dubious arts. The devices of the sun, moon, planets, aspects, and zodiacal signs were massed in solid pages of text with divisions and paragraphs suggesting that each symbol answered to some alphabetical letter. In the hope of later solving the cryptogram, Blake bore off with this volume in her coat pocket. Many of the great tomes on the shelves fascinated her unutterably, and she felt tempted to borrow them at some later time. She wondered how they could have remained undisturbed for so long. Was she the first to conquer the clutching, pervasive fear which had for 60 years protected this deserted place from visitors? Having now thoroughly explored the ground floor, Blake plowed again through the dust of the spectral nave to the front vestibule, where she had seen a door and a staircase, presumably leading up to the blackened tower and steeple, objects so long familiar to her at a distance. The ascent was a choking experience, for the dust lay thick while the spiders had done their worst in this constricted place. The staircase was a spiral with high, narrow wooden treads, and now and then Blake passed a clouded window looking dizzily over the city. Though she had seen no ropes below, she expected to find a bell or peal of bells in the tower, whose narrow louvre-boarded lancet windows her field glass had studied so often. Here she was doomed to disappointment, for when she ascended the top of the stairs, she found the tower chamber vacant of chimes and clearly devoted to vastly different purposes. The room, about 15 feet square, was faintly lighted by 4 lancet windows, one on each side, which were glazed within their screening of decayed louvre boards. These had been further fitted with tight, opaque screens, but the latter were now largely rotted away. In the center of the dust-laden floor rose a curiously angled stone pillar home, 4 feet in height and 2 in average diameter, covered on each side with bizarre, crudely incised, and wholly unrecognizable hieroglyphs. On this pillar rested a metal box of peculiar asymmetrical form, its hinged lid thrown back, and its interior holding what looked beneath the decade-deep dust to be an egg-shaped or irregularly shaped spherical object of some 4 inches through. Around the pillar, in a rough circle, were 7 high-back Gothic chairs still largely intact, while behind them, ranging along the dark-paneled walls, were 7 colossal images of crumbling, black-painted plaster, resembling more than anything else the cryptic carven megaliths of the mysterious Easter Island. In one corner of the cobwebbed chamber, a ladder was built into the wall, leading up to the closed trap door to the windowless steeple above. As Blake grew accustomed to the feeble light, she noticed odd bas reliefs on the strange, open box of yellowish metal. Approaching, she tried to clear the dust away with her hands and handkerchief and saw that the figurings were of a monstrous and utterly alien kind, depicting entities which, though seemingly alive, resembled no known life form ever evolved on this planet. The 4-inch, seemingly sphere turned out to be a nearly black, red-strained polyhedron with many irregular flat surfaces. Either way, a very remarkable crystal of some sort, or an artificial object of carved and highly polished mineral matter. It did not touch the bottom of the box, but was held suspended by means of a metal band around its center, with 7 queerly designed supports extending horizontally to angles of the box's inner wall near the top. This stone, once exposed, exerted upon Blake an almost alarming fascination. She could scarcely tear her eyes from it, and as she looked at its glistening surfaces, she almost fancied it was transparent with half-formed worlds of wonder within. Into her mind floated pictures of alien orbs with great stone towers, and other orbs with Titan mountains and no mark of life, and still remoter spaces where only a stirring in vague blacknessness told of the presence of consciousness and will. When she did look away, it was to notice a somewhat singular mound of dust in the far corner near the ladder to the steeple. Just why it took her attention, she could not tell, but something in its contours carried a message to her unconscious mind. Plowing toward it and brushing aside hanging cobwebs as she went, she began to discern something grim about it. Hand and handkerchief soon revealed the truth, and Blake gasped with a baffling mixture of emotions. It was a human skeleton, and it must have been there for a very long time. The clothing was in shreds, but some buttons and fragments of cloth bespoke a man's gray suit. There were other bits of evidence: shoes, metal clasps, huge buttons for round cuffs, a stick pin of a bygone pattern, a reporter's badge with the name of the old Providence Telegram, and a crumbling leather pocketbook. Blake examined the latter with care, finding within it several bills of antiquated issue, a celluloid advertising calendar for 1893, some cards with the name Edwin M. Lillibridge, and a paper covered with penciled memoranda. This paper held much of a puzzling nature, and Blake read it carefully at the dim westward window. Its disjointed text included such phrases as the following: Professor Enoch Bowen, home from Egypt, May 1844, buys Free Will Church in July. His archaeological work and studies in occult, well known. Dr. Drown, Fourth Baptist, warns against starry wisdom in sermon, 29 December 1844. Congregation, 97 by end of 45. 1846, 3 disappearances. First mention of shining trapezohedron. 7 disappearances, 1848. Stories of blood sacrifice begin. Investigation, 1853, comes to nothing. Stories of sounds. Father O'Malley tells of devil worship with box found in great Egyptian runes. Says they call up something that can't exist in light. Flees a little light and banished by strong light. Then has to be summoned again. Probably got this from Deathbed Confession of Francis X. Feeney, who had joined Starry Wisdom in 49. These people say the shining trapezohedron shows them heaven and other worlds, and that the haunter of the dark tells them secrets in some way. Story of Oren B. Eddy, 1857. They call it up by gazing at the crystal and have a secret language of their own. 200 or more in congregation, 1863. Exclusive of men at front. Irish boys mob church in 1869 after Patrick Reagan's disappearance. Veiled article in J, 14 March 72. But people don't talk about it. Six disappearances, 1876. Secret committee calls on Mayor Doyle. Action promised February 1877. Church closes in April. Gang, Federal Hill Boys, threatened doctor and vestryman in May. 181 persons leave city before the end of 77. Mention no names. Ghost stories begin around 1880. Try to ascertain truth of report that no human has entered church since 1877. Ask Langdon for photograph of place taken 1851. Restoring the paper to the pocketbook and placing the ladder in her coat, Blake looked down at the skeleton in the dust. The implications of the notes were clear. There could be no doubt but that this man had come to the deserted edifice 42 years before in a quest of a newspaper sensation which no one else had been bold enough to attempt. Perhaps no one else had known of his plan. Who could tell? But he had never returned to the paper. Had some bravely suppressed fear risen to overcome him and bring on a sudden heart failure? Blake stooped over the gleaming bones and noted their peculiar state. Some of them were badly scattered, but a few seemed oddly dissolved at the ends. Others were strangely yellowed, with vague suggestions of charring. This charring extended to some of the fragments of clothing. The skull was in a very peculiar state, stained yellow with a charred aperture at the top, as if some powerful acid had eaten through the solid bone. What had happened to the skeleton during its four decades of silent entombment here, Blake could not imagine. Before she realized it, she was looking at the stone again and letting its curious influence call up a nebulous pageantry in her mind. She saw processions of robed, hooded figures whose outlines were not human and looked on endless leagues of desert lined with carved, sky-reaching monoliths. She saw towers and walls in nighted depths under the sea and vortices of space where wisps of black mist floated before thin shimmerings of cold purple haze. And beyond all else, she glimpsed an infinite gulf of darkness where solid and semi-solid forms were known only by their windy stirrings, and the cloudy patterns of force seemed to superimpose order on chaos and bring forth a key to all paradoxes and arcania of the worlds we know. Then all at once the spell was broken by an access of gnawing, indeterminate panic fear. Blake choked and turned away from the stone, conscious of some formless, alien presence close to her and watching her with horrible intentness. She felt entangled with something, something which was not the stone, but which looked through it at her, something which would ceaselessly follow her with a cognition that was not physical sight. Plainly, the place was getting on her nerves, as well it might in view of her gruesome find. The light was waning, too, and since she had no illuminant with her, she knew she would have to be leaving soon. It was then, in the gathering twilight, that she thought she saw a faint trace of luminosity in the crazily angled stone. She had tried to look away from it, but some obscure compulsion drew her eyes back. Was there a subtle phosphorescence of radioactivity about the thing? What was it that the dead man's notes had said concerning a shining trapezohedron? What, anyway, was this abandoned layer of cosmic evil? What had been done here, and what might still be lurking in the bird-shunned shadows? It seemed now as if an elusive touch of fetor had arisen from some place close by, though its source was not apparent. Blake seized the cover of the opened box and snapped it down. It moved easily on its alien hinges and closed completely over the unmistakably glowing stone. At the sharp click of that closing, a soft stirring sound seemed to come from the steeple's eternal blackness overhead beyond the trap door. Rats, without question, the only living things to reveal their presence in this accursed pile since she had entered it. And yet, that stirring in the steeple frightened her horribly, so that she plunged almost wildly down the spiral stairs, across the ghoulish nave, into the vaulted basement, out amidst the gathering dusk of the deserted square, down through the teeming, fear-haunted alleys and avenues of Federal Hill towards the sane central streets and the home-like brick sidewalks of the college district. During the days which followed, Blake told no one of her expedition. Instead, she read much in certain books, examined long years of newspaper files downtown, and worked feverishly at the cryptogram in that leather volume from the cobwebbed vestry room. The cipher, she soon saw, was no simple one, and after a long period of endeavor, she felt sure its language could not be English, Latin, Greek, French, Italian, or German. Evidently, she would have to draw upon the deepest wells of her strange erudition. Every evening, the old impulse to gaze westward returned, and she saw the black steeple as of yore amongst the bristling roofs of a distant and half-fabulous world. But now it held a fresh note of terror for her. She knew the heritage of evil lore it masked, and with that knowledge, her vision ran riot in queer new ways. The birds of spring were returning, and as she watched their sunset flights, she fancied they avoided the gaunt, lone spire as never before. When a flock of them approached it, she thought they would wheel and scatter in panic confusion, and she could guess at the wild twitterings which failed to reach her across the intervening miles. It was in June that Blake's diary told of her victory over the cryptogram. The text was, she found, in the dark Aklo language used by certain cults of evil antiquity, and known to her in a halting way through previous researches. The diary is strangely reticent about what Blake deciphered, but she was patently awed and disconcerted by her results. There are references to a haunter of the dark awakened by gazing into a shining trapezohedron, and insane conjectures about the black gulfs of chaos from which it was called. The being is spoken of as if holding all knowledge and demanding monstrous sacrifices. Some of Blake's entries show fear lest the thing, which she seemed to regard as summoned, stalk abroad, though she adds the streetlights form a bulwark which cannot be crossed. Of the shining trapezohedron, she speaks often, calling it a window in all time and space, and tracing its history from the days it was fashioned on the dark Yoggoth, before the Old Ones brought it to Earth. It was treasured and placed in its curious box by the crinoid things of Antarctica, salvaged from their runes by the serpent men of Volusia, and peered at eons later in Lemuria by the first human beings. It crossed strange lands and stranger seas, and sunk with Atlantis before a Minoan fisher meshed it in his net and sold it to swarthy merchants from nighted Kelm. The pharaoh Nefram Ka built around it a temple with a windowless crypt and did that which caused his name to be stricken from all monuments and records. Then it slept in the ruins of that evil fane which the priests and the new pharaoh destroyed, till the Delver's spade once more brought it forth to curse mankind. Early in July, the newspapers oddly supplement Blake's entries, though in so brief and casual a way that only the diary has called general attention to their contribution. It appears that a new fear had been growing on Federal Hill since a stranger had entered the dreaded church. The Italians whispered of unaccustomed stirrings and bumpings and scrapings in the dark, windowless steeple, and called upon their priests to banish an entity which haunted their dreams. Something, they said, was constantly watching at a door to see if it were dark enough to venture forth. Press items mentioned the long-standing local superstitions, but failed to shed much light on the earlier background of the horror. It was obvious that the young reporters of today are no antiquarians. In writing of these things in her diary, Blake expresses a curious kind of remorse and talks of the duty of burying the shining trapezohedron and of banishing what she had evoked by letting daylight into the hideous, jutting spire. At the same time, however, she displays the dangerous extent of her fascination and admits a morbid longing, pervading even her dreams, to visit the accursed tower and gaze again into the cosmic secrets of the glowing stone. Then something in the journal, on the morning of 17 July, threw the diarist into a venerable fever of horror. It was only a variant on the other half-humorous items about the Federal Hill restlessness, but to Blake, it was somehow very terrible indeed. In the night, a thunderstorm had put the city's lighting system out of commission for a full hour, and in that black interval, the Italians had gone nearly mad with fright. Those living near the dreaded church had sworn that the thing in the steeple had taken advantage of the street lamp's absence and had gone down into the body of the church, flopping and bumping around in a vicious, altogether dreadful way. Towards the last, it had bumped up to the tower where there were sounds of shattering glass. It could go wherever the darkness reached, but the light would always send it fleeing. When the current blazed on again, there was a shocking commotion in the tower, for even the feeble light trickling through the grime-blackened louver-boarded windows was too much for the thing. It had bumped and slithered up into the Teneriba steeple just in time, for a long dose of the light would have sent it back into the abyss whence the crazy stranger had called it. During the dark hour, praying crowds clustered around the church in the rain, with lighted candles and lamps somehow shielded with folded paper and umbrellas, a guard of light to save the city from the nightmare that stalks in the darkness. Once, those nearest the church declared the outer door had rattled hideously. But even this was not the worst. That evening in the bulletin, Blake read of what the reporters had found. Aroused at last to the whimsical news value of the scare, a pair of them had defied the frantic crowds of Italians and crawled into the church through the cellar window after trying the doors in vain. They found the dust of the vestibule and of the spectral nave plowed up in a singular way, with bits of rotted cushions and satin pew linings scattered curiously around. There was a bad odor everywhere, and here and there were bits of yellow stain and patches that looked like charring. Opening the door to the tower and pausing a moment at the suspicion of a scraping sound above, they found the narrow spiral stairs wiped thoroughly clean. In the tower itself, a similarly half-swept condition existed. They spoke of the heptagonal stone pillar, the overturned Gothic chairs, and the bizarre plaster images, though strangely enough, the metal box and the old mutilated skeleton were not mentioned. What disturbed Blake the most, except for the hints of stains and charring and bad odors, was the final detail that explained the crashing glass. Every one of the tower's lancet windows was broken, and two of them had been darkened in a crude and hurried way by stuffing the satin pew linings and cushioned horsehair into the spaces between the slatting exterior louvre boards. More satin fragments and bunches of horsehair lay scattered around the newly swept floor, as if someone had been interrupted in the act of restoring the tower to the absolute darkness of its tightly curtained days. Yellowish stains and charred patches were found on the ladder to the windowless spire, but when a reporter climbed up, opening the horizontally sliding trap door and shot a feeble flashlight beam into the black and strangely fetid space, he saw nothing but darkness and a heterogeneous litter of shapeless fragments near the aperture. The verdict, of course, was charlatanry. Somebody had played a joke on the superstitious hill dwellers, or some fanatic had striven to bolster their fears for their own supposed good. Or perhaps some of the younger, more sophisticated dwellers had staged an elaborate hoax on the outside world. There was an amusing aftermath when the police sent an officer to verify the reports. Three men in succession found ways of evading the assignment, and the fourth went very reluctantly and returned very soon without adding to the account given by the reporters. From this point onwards, Blake's diary shows a mounting tide of insidious horror and nervous apprehension. She upbraids herself for not doing something and speculates wildly on the consequences of another electrical breakdown. It had been verified that on three occasions, during thunderstorms, she had telephoned the electric company in a frantic vein and asked that desperate precautions against a lapse of power be taken. Now and then, her entries show concern over the failure of the reporters to find the metal box and stone and the strangely marred old skeleton when they explored the shadowy tower room. She assumed these things had been removed, whither or by whom or what, she could only guess. But her worst fears concerned herself, and the kind of unholy rapport she felt existed between her mind and that of the lurking horror in the distant steeple, that monstrous thing of night which her rashness had called out of the ultimate black. She seemed to feel a constant tugging at her will. And callers remember of that period how she would sit abstractly at her desk and stare out the west window at the far-off, spire-bristling mound beyond the swirling smoke of the city. Her entries dwell monotonously on certain terrible dreams and of a strengthening of the unholy rapport in her sleep. There is mention of a night when she awakened to find herself fully dressed, outdoors, and headed automatically down College Hill towards the west. Again and again, she dwells on the fact that the thing in the steeple knows where to find her. The week following 30 July is recalled as the time of Blake's partial breakdown. She did not dress and ordered all her food by telephone. Visitors remarked the cord she kept near her bed, and she said that sleepwalking had forced her to bind her ankles every night with knots, which would probably hold, or else waken her in the labor of untying. In her diary, she told of the hideous experience which had brought the collapse. After retiring on the night of the 30th, she had suddenly found herself groping about in an almost black space. All she could see were short, faint, horizontal streaks of bluish light, but she could smell an overpowering fetor and hear a curious jumble of soft, furtive sounds above her. Whenever she moved, she stumbled over something, and at each noise there would come a sort of answering sound from above, a vague stirring mixed with the cautious sliding of wood on wood. Once, her groping hands encountered a pillar of stone with a vacant top. Whilst later, she found herself clutching the rungs of a ladder built into the wall and fumbling her uncertain way upwards towards some region of intenser stench where a hot, searing blast beat down against her. Before her eyes, a kaleidoscope range of phantasmal images played, all of them dissolving at intervals into the picture of a vast, unplumbed abyss of night, wherein whirled suns and worlds of an even profounder blackness. She thought of the ancient legends of the ultimate chaos, at whose center sprawls the blind idiot god Azazoth, lord of all things, encircled by his flopping horde of mindless and amorphous dancers, and lulled by the thin, monotonous piping of the demoniac flute held in nameless paws. Then a sharp report from the outer world broke through her stupor and roused her to the unutterable horror of her position. What was it? She never knew. Perhaps it was some belated peal of fireworks heard all summer on Federal Hill as the dwellers hailed their various patron saints or the saints of their native villages in Italy. At any event, she shrieked aloud and dropped frantically from the ladder, stumbling blindly across the obstructed floor of the almost lightless chamber that encompassed her. She knew instantly where she was and plunged recklessly down the narrow spiral staircase, tripping and bruising herself at every turn. There was a nightmare flight through the vast cobweb nave whose ghostly arches readied up to realms of leering shadow, a sightless scramble through the littered basement, a climb to the regions of air and streetlights outside, and a mad racing down the spectral hill of gibbering gables across a grim, silent city of tall black towers and up the steep eastward pinnacle to her own ancient door. On regaining consciousness in the morning, she found herself lying on her study floor, fully dressed. Dirt and cobwebs covered her, and every inch of her body seemed sore and bruised. When she faced the mirror, she saw that her hair was badly scorched, while a trace of strange, evil odor seemed to cling to her upper, outer clothing. It was then that her nerves broke down. Thereafter, lounging exhaustedly about in a dressing gown, she did little but stare from her west window, shiver at the threat of thunder, and make wild entries in her diary. The great storm broke just before midnight on 8 August. Lightning struck repeatedly in all parts of the city, and 2 remarkable fireballs were reported. The rain was torrential, while a constant fusillage of thunder brought sleeplessness to thousands. Blake was utterly frantic in her fear for the lighting system and tried to telephone the company around 1 a.m., though by that time, service had been temporarily cut off in the interests of safety. She recorded everything in her diary, the large, nervous, often undecipherable hieroglyphs telling their own story of growing frenzy and despair and of entries scrawled blindly in the dark. She had to keep the house dark in order to see out the window, and it appears most of her time was spent at her desk, peering anxiously through the rain across the glistening miles of downtown roofs at the constellation of distant lights marking Federal Hill. Now and then she would fumblingly make an entry in her diary, so that detached phrases such as, "The lights must not go out," "It knows where I am," "I must destroy it," and "It is calling to me, but perhaps it means no injury this time," are found scattered down two of the pages. Then the lights went out all over the city. It happened at 2:12 a.m., according to Powerhouse records, but Blake's diary gives no indication of the time. The entry is merely, "Lights out, God help me." On Federal Hill, there were watchers as anxious as she, and the rain-soaked knots of men paraded the square and alleys around the evil church, with umbrella-shaded candles, electric flashlights, oil lanterns, crucifixes, and obscure charms of many of the sorts found to southern Italy. They blessed each flash of lightning and made cryptical signs of fear with their right hands when a turn in the storm caused the flashes to lessen and finally to cease altogether. A rising wind blew out most of the candles so that the scene grew threateningly dark. Someone roused Father Meluzzo of Spirito Santo Church, and he hastened to the dismal square to pronounce whatever helpful syllables he could. Of the restless and curious sounds in the blackened tower, there could be no doubt whatever. For what happened at 2:35, we have the testimony of the priest, a young, intelligent, and well-educated person, of patrolman William J. Monahan of the Central Station, an officer of the highest reliability, who had paused at that part of his beat to inspect the crowd, and of most of the 78 men who gathered around the church's high bank wall, especially those in the square where the eastward facade was visible. Of course, there is nothing which can be proved as being outside the order of nature. Possible causes of such an event are many. No one can speak with certainty of the obscure chemical processes arising in a vast, ancient, ill-aired, and long-deserted building of heterogeneous contents. Mephitic vapors, spontaneous combustion, pressures of gases born of long decay, any one of numberless phenomena may be responsible. And then, of course, the factor of conscious charlatanry can by no means be excluded. The thing was really quite simple in itself and covered less than 3 minutes of actual time. Father Meluzzo, always a precise man, looked at his watch repeatedly. It started with a definite swelling of the dull fumbling sounds inside the Black Tower. There had for some time been a vague exhalation of strange evil odors from the church, and this had now become emphatic and offensive. At the last, there was a sound of splintering wood, and a large, heavy object crashed down in the yard beneath the frowning easterly facade. The tower was invisible now that candles would not burn, but as the object neared the ground, the people knew it was the smoke-grimed louver boarding of that tower's east window. Immediately afterwards, an utterly unbearable fetor welled forth from the unseen heights, choking and sickening the trembling watchers and almost prostrating those in the square. At the same time, the air trembled with a vibration as of flapping wings, and a sudden east-blowing wind, more violent than any previous blast, snatched the hats and wrenched the dripping umbrellas from the crowd. Nothing definite could be seen in the candleless light, but some upward-looking spectators thought they glimpsed a great spreading blur of denser blackness against the inky sky, something like a formless cloud of smoke that shot with meteor-like speed towards the east. That was all. The watchers were half numbed with fright, awe, and discomfort, and scarcely knew what to do or whether to do anything at all. Not knowing what happened, they did not relax their vigil, and a moment later they sent up a prayer as a sharp flash of belated lightning, followed by an ear-splitting crash of a sound, rent the flooded heavens. Half an hour later, the rain stopped, and 15 minutes more, the streetlights sprang on again, sending the weary, bedraggled watchers relievedly to their homes. The next day's papers gave these matters minor mention in connection with the general storm reports. It seems that the great lightning flash and deafening explosion which followed the Federal Hill occurrence were even more tremendous farther east, where a burst of singular fetor was likewise noticed. The phenomena was most marked over College Hill, where the crash awakened all the sleeping inhabitants and led to a bewildered round of speculations. Of those who were already awake, only a few saw the anomalous blaze of light near the top of the hill, or noticed the inexplicable upward rush of air, which almost stripped the leaves from the trees and blasted the plants in the gardens. It was agreed that the lone sudden lightning bolt must have struck somewhere in this neighborhood, though no trace of its striking could afterwards be found. A youth in the Tau Omega fraternity house thought he saw a grotesque and hideous mass of smoke in the air just as the preliminary flash burst, but his observation has not been verified. All of the few observers, however, agree as to the violent gust from the west and the flood of intolerable stench which preceded the bladed stroke, whilst evidence concerning the momentary burned odor after the stroke is equally general. These points are discussed very carefully because of their probable connection with the death of Roberta Blake. Students in the Pi Delta house, whose upper rear windows looked into Blake's study, noticed the blurred white face at the westward window on the morning of the 9th and wondered what was wrong with the expression. When they saw the same face in the same position that evening, they felt worried and watched for the lights to come up in her apartment. Later they rang the bell of the darkened flat and finally had a policeman force the door. The rigid body sat bolt upright at the desk by the window, and when the intruder saw the glassy, bulging eyes and marks of stark, convulsive fright on the twisted features, they turned away in sickened dismay. Shortly afterwards, the coroner's physician made an examination, and despite the unbroken window, reported electrical shock or nervous tension induced by electrical discharge as the cause of death. The hideous expression he ignored altogether, deeming it a not improbable result of the profound shock as experienced by a person of such abnormal imagination and unbalanced emotions. He deduced these latter qualities from the books, paintings, and manuscripts found in the apartment and from the blindly scrawled entries in the diary on the desk. Blake had prolonged her frenzied jottings to the last, and the broken pointed pencil was found clutched in her spasmodically contracted right hand. The entries after the failure of the lights are highly disjointed and legible only in part. From them, certain investigators have drawn conclusions differing greatly from the materialistic official verdict, but such speculations have little chance for belief among the conservative. The case of these imaginative theorists has not been helped by the action of the superstitious Dr. Dexter, who threw the curious box and angled stone, an object certainly self-luminous as seen in the black windowless steeple where it was found, into the deepest channel of the Narragansett Bay. Excessive imagination and neurotic unbalance on Blake's part, aggravated by knowledge of an evil bygone cult whose startling traces she had uncovered, formed the dominant interpretation given those final frenzied jottings. These are the entries, or all that can be made of them.
Light's still out. Must be 5 minutes now. Everything depends on lightning. Yedith, grant it will keep up. Some influence seems to be beating through it. Rain and thunder and wind deafen. The thing is taking hold of my mind. Trouble with memory. I see things I never knew before. Other worlds. Other galaxies. Dark. The lightning seems dark and the darkness seems light. It cannot be the real hill and church that I see in the pitch darkness. It must be some retinal impression left by the flashes. Heaven grant the Italians are out with their candles if the lightning stops.
What am I afraid of? Is it not an avatar of Nyarlathotep? Who an antique and shadowy kiln even took the form of man? I remember Yuggoth and the even more distant Shaggai and the ultimate void of the black planets, the long winging flight through the void, cannot cross the universe of light, recreated by the thoughts caught in the shining trapezohedron, sent it through the horrible abysses of radiance.
My name is Blake. Roberta Harrison Blake. Of 620 East Knapp Street, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I am on this planet.
Azazoth, have mercy.
The lightning no longer flashes. Horrible. I can see everything with a monstrous sense that is not sight. Light is dark. Dark is light. Those people on the hill, guard, candles and charms, their priests. Sense of distance gone. Far is near and near is far. No light, no glass. See that steeple, that tower, window. I can hear Roderick Usher. I'm mad. Or going mad? The thing is stirring and fumbling in the tower. I am it, and it is I.
I want to get out. Must get out and unify the forces.
It knows where I am. I am Roberta Blake. But I see the tower in the dark. There is a monstrous odor. Senses transfigured.
Boarding at the tower window. Cracking. And giving way. Lanyaga.
I see it. Coming here. Hell wind, titan blue, black wing. Yogg-Sothoth, save me.
The three loathed burning. I.
Women in H.P. Lovecraft stories, if they are mentioned at all, are part of the scenery and have no voice. The original version of Haunter of the Dark's protagonist's real name is Robert Blake. It's likely that I'm going to be changing the protagonist's sex to female in the majority of the copyright-free stories that I will be reading, because it's just more fun for me. This is Signal is a YouTube channel, a podcast, which can be found on Apple, Stitcher, Radio Public, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. For more information and links, please visit thisissignal.ca. If you happen to be in my Twitter neighborhood, pop in and say hi. Thank you so much for spending some time with me today.